So here we are at the afternoon of the first day of the retreat, and I bet there's a room full of all kinds of responses about the first day. The first day, as I said this morning, is the often tiredness and restlessness and things come on, but that's just like the surface of, there's a tip of this iceberg. Some people are, some of you probably wondering, what did I sign up for? And or you have a headache. Or you somehow, you know, it's surprised by what comes up, emotions get revealed or something. Historically, for many people, the first day is a rough day. And if you like, you can take it as initiation. If you'd like, you can see it as just the warming up, kind of getting oriented and finding your way and dealing with the transition. And it's an important day. It's no amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. It's an important day, and if today was a struggle, don't write it off as being a waste. It might be very, very important. Sometimes it's important to struggle, to go through these days, and you don't really know what maybe it's about and what's coming as a result of it. But it may be useful just to acknowledge that first day can be a challenge in a variety of ways, and again, you don't have to see that as abnormal. It may be part of the process. And it is a process. I think it's useful to think of this as a journey, as a path. The Buddha used the metaphor of a path to describe the practice, and I think often has that a sense that we're involved in a process that unfolds and builds and grows over time. So in that sense, it's a path, and a path that exists in a very significant way, but it also a path that we create and make as we go along. And I think the real path for each of us is something we make as we practice, as we take the steps along it. And as we do that, we unfold, we open up, we process, we proceed in all kinds of ways. And one of the results of my practice is to have a tremendous faith and trust in that process, what unfolds. I don't always know what's to expect. I often don't know what to expect. But I've learned that if I offer my sincere effort to the practice, then the path opens up, the process unfolds, and it's often quite significant. And, you know, in coming on retreat, there's a wonderful, I think a very meaningful participation or involvement with something that human beings have done for millennia, probably. It's sometimes called the cycles of withdrawal and return. And sometimes it's very useful to step away from our life as it's usually lived into some radical other kind of space in order to let the thoughts, the feelings, the emotions, associations of different or normal life fall away enough that we can experience ourselves in a new way, a different way, and then in a different way go back to the life we left with a different eyes, with a different heart, with a different way of understanding it. And so whether it's 40 days in the desert or vision quests or, you know, there's all kinds of rituals that people do down through the ages where they somehow leave their life behind. And and often what happens in these kinds of ritual ceremonies of withdrawal and return is that your identity of who you were in society, you allow it to fall away for the time you're on the retreat away. So if you had a role in society or an identity or a status or something, that would fall away and wouldn't be there while you enter into this kind of special sacred space of the ritual of the withdrawal. And let all that kind of fall away, all the thoughts, the associations, the identity, in order to discover something deeper about ourselves. And then there's that's the withdrawal, the retreat. This is a retreat, right? So we've retreated, and then there's the return, and both are important. There's like two sides of the hand. Both are needed, and then we return. And to some degree, maybe it's not exactly the same for all of us, but at least in kind of principle or something, we're returning to the life we had before, but with new eyes, with a new heart. So it's not a matter of getting someplace new on the journey, but rather being new, renewed ourselves with new eyes, a new heart for the place where we're already at. One of the little axioms that exists in some teaching, in our scene, our little teaching, is that the fastest way to journey from A to B, point A to point B, is to be completely in point A. So that we just really be here, because if you're focusing so much on the goal, getting someplace, then it slows you down. But if you can just do this kind of process, you really fully be here. Or maybe to say it differently, we're on a journey from A to A. And mostly we don't know we're at A, and so we don't really kind of inhabit this space, this body, this place in a very full way, in a way that it becomes vibrant, alive, and special. And so we're discovering how to enter this world here in a full way. And one of the ways we do that is to understand all the different forces of mind that keep us from being here. So the list of the five hindrances, which is a theme for this retreat, is a very important thing to become familiar with, because you want to become familiar with what takes you away, what obscures your ability to be here in an effective, wise way. And the more you can understand that, the wiser you can be about it. So really can learn how to be here in a full way, in a meaningful way. And this journey that we're on, it begins by somehow acknowledging where we're at. We're not like a rejection of our life, but then we enter into it, into this different kind of world where we start shedding, letting go of things that we're caught in. And then with that, we can come back, hopefully in a very different way. The different way, you know, things, this is where, you know, things, we often operate in our lives one way, and it's possible to operate in a much wiser way. And maybe things, it takes a while to learn that there are other ways, other processes by which we can live our lives, which are not so obvious from the kind of the usual way society works. And that's symbolized or represented by the Buddhist monastic. Last week we had a short retreat with a Buddhist monk named Ajahn Amaro right here. I've known him for many years, some 30 years or so. And a lovely man, very wise. He's lots of fun. One of the people who was there said that he became a student many years ago when he heard him give a talk about renunciation. And for many people, to hear the topic renunciation, it should be pronounced renunciation. Renunciation. When Ajahn means teacher, Ajahn Amaro gave this talk on renunciation, he was grinning from ear to ear. And that's what kind of got him interested in Ajahn Amaro and what he had to teach. So one of the things I've seen about Ajahn Amaro, I believe he's genuinely a very content monk, owning almost nothing. He owns his bowl, his robes, he has no bank account as far as I can tell, no money. He's a renunciate, he has nothing. And once he was, someone went, took him for a tour of the San Francisco Financial District, explained, he's from England, so he didn't know about American, you know, how American society, economy works. And the guy turned to Ajahn Amaro and said to him, you're wealthier than most Americans. And Ajahn Amaro didn't have any money at all. He said, you know, what? How does that work, you know? And his guide said, most Americans are in debt. And Ajahn Amaro has no debt. So, one of the things I've noticed about him is he's very content to live a very simple life, but he lives nicer than most people I know. Many years ago, maybe it was just before smartphones there were or something, he had like one of the early versions of smartphones, and I looked at him and said, Ajahn Amaro, you're a renunciant. What are you doing with it? Back then it was a very expensive phone, you know, it was like, I don't know, $1,000 or something. It was a big deal to have this thing. Well, Ajahn Amaro, what are you doing with this phone? Could you do email even back then, 10 years ago or something? And he said, well, someone gave it to me. And I figured it was okay to have it as a gift, as long as if anybody asked me for it, I'd give it to them. And I was tempted. So this idea of this guy who's given up everything and then having this expensive phone is kind of kind of points to something different is operating here. That's different than when you pursue your normal desires, pursue your kind of life and getting and wanting and building and doing stuff. There's something else can happen. Something else can arise from deep in the heart, not just cell phones, but deep in the heart. And that's really what's important, not the cell phones. Deep in the heart, you find a different motivation, different way of finding a way in the world. That's probably very different than how we normally operate, but it requires being quiet enough and still enough to really listen and to respect what's deep inside, what's here. So to really be here in A is to really be here in some way we can listen and hear ourselves and be connected in a very deep way that allows something different to come up. So the five hindrances are an important part of this journey. And the five hindrances, the word for hindrances in Pali, the Buddhist language, is nivarana. And nivarana literally means a covering, something that covers over. And maybe it's a little bit better translation than hindrance, because hindrance makes it kind of like a problem more than maybe it needs to be seen. But it's that which covers over something. And one of the things it's said to cover over is our wisdom, our ability to see clearly, and to be wise and to act wise. When the hindrances are there, we don't see very clearly, and we tend to make mistakes. And so like one of the first hindrances is a sensual desire. And I've heard Jack Kornfield give talks about such things, and he says, raise your hand if you have never made a fool of yourself with your sexual desires. Well, no one dares to raise their hand, but maybe there's a lot of people who haven't made a fool of themselves, or something equivalent. But sometimes people don't operate, at least when they were teenagers, don't operate their wisest when they have certain passions. I can tell you stories, but maybe I shouldn't. One story is I think it was maybe 14 or 15, and there was a young woman my age who I met somehow on the street and somewhere, and I knew her first name, and I followed her home to her street, and so I really wanted to see her again, but all I knew was her first name and the street she lived on. And so my friend and I went through the telephone book, and I went from the front and he went from the back, and we called everyone who lived on that street asking for her. That's quite something. So I didn't exactly make a fool of myself, but that's quite a drive, I think. And I found her. But that didn't go very well. I was 14. I didn't know anything about smoking cigarettes, but I thought it would be cool and show off to her. So I tried to smoke a cigarette. I tried to light a cigarette, but I didn't know how it was done. And that didn't go well. I don't know if that was the reason the whole relationship didn't go anywhere, but it was awkward time. So the first of the hindrances is sensual desire, and so desires are really important part of human life. We're more than human beings. Few of us just be. We're more like human desirelings because of how much desire is part of our lives. And it's very important not to see desire, have a policy that desire is wrong or bad. Desire is just like an umbrella term for a variety of different motivators that we have. And craving, thirst, grasping, addiction are kinds of desires which hurt. It's painful to have them, and it often lead to painful consequences. But there's also desires which come from deep in our hearts. There's aspiration. We can have. I love the word aspiration because the word aspire comes from the word to breathe in Latin. So it's like same as the word spiritual. It comes from the word breath. And so we can have beautiful aspirations. Compassion is a kind of aspiration of the heart. Generosity, we want to, we have a desire to be generous to someone. I can come from a deep place inside, an aspiration. Whereas addictions, cravings, thirsts, I would suggest that they're not really that deep in us. They tend to be surface things. We're trying to deal with things on the surface in order to maybe sometimes try to alleviate or take care of something deep inside, but it doesn't. It kind of keeps us on the surface of things, and it doesn't really allow us to drop in deep. It actually interferes with it, as many addicts have discovered, where the pursuit of pleasure is only skin deep, they say. Happiness is heart deep, and it's better to be in the heart than it is to be just in the skin. So if the desire is simply for pleasure, it doesn't help us to go very deep. Or the desire for material goods. Once we have our basic needs taken care of, we go beyond what's needed. And sometimes when we're too addicted to wanting material goods or status or money, when it doesn't come from aspiration, but comes from kind of craving and clinging and status and wanting security and all these things, it's all too easy for us to leave us kind of superficial, leave us kind of not really deeply connected to either ourselves or the world around us. So, when we're caught up in desire strongly, it's very hard to be in the present moment. So some of you, if you looked back over the day today and saw some of the forces in the mind that made it difficult for you to be present, you would probably see that some of them had to do with desires, wanting something. Maybe you spend a lot of time in fantasy and imagining, planning for something wonderful to happen. Or, there could be all kinds of fantasies. Fantasies about the lunch. What are they going to serve? And fantasies about sex. We don't serve that. So there's all these, all kinds of things that are around desire. The opposite hindrance, which is the second one, which we'll cover tomorrow, is aversion. So there can be lost in having aversion, pushing things away, being critical, being judgmental. This is bad. This is wrong. How could they do this? And so the mind gets caught in that. And in that caughtness in these things, we're not very deep. So I want to give you a little exercise on caughtness, what that's like. Because one of the things we want to do in this practice is not to only understand things, but we want to feel them. We want to kind of have the experience in our bodies of how these things work. So maybe start, just take a comfortable posture. You can sit as you wish, as you are if you wish, but to close your eyes. And we're not going to do this for very long, but just take a few moments to settle in. Take a few deep breaths, perhaps. Exhale and relax, settle in. Let your breath return to normal. And then take a few moments to see if there's any other places in your body you can relax. So maybe you can relax your shoulders. Maybe there can be a softening of the face. A releasing of the face. Maybe a softening of the belly. A relaxing of the muscles of the legs, the thighs, or of the arms. And some people are bracing themselves against life with their whole body. Maybe for a few moments now, you can soften up, ease up on that. Just be here. And Some people are very engaged in their eyes, even if their eyes are closed, trying to look, trying to understand. See if maybe it's possible, just ever so lightly, to soften in the eyes. Let your eyes settle back in their sockets. Or almost without trying, some people find if they kind of imagine their eyes looking back and down rather than out, their eyes maybe relax a little bit. And gently, ever so gently, become aware of your body breathing. Don't try too hard, but just kind of gently, like you come to the edges of breathing. Experience your body inhaling and exhaling in the chest, rib cage, or belly, anywhere you feel it. For just a few rounds of breathing, just kind of tune into what it feels like to breathe, but try to do it without a big deal. Just lightly, maybe from a distance you're with your breathing, or maybe you're resting in the breath, but just kind of two or three times as you breathe, two or three breaths, feel your breathing. And if it's possible to ease up or relax or lighten the muscles that are involved in breathing, see if you can just soften a little bit so breathing is a little bit easier maybe. Feeling the rhythm. And so in a moment, I'm going to ask you to open your eyes and find a spot, a little spot, maybe no bigger than a dime or something, on the floor or something in front of you. And take your eyes and look at that spot. So go ahead, find a little spot, doesn't matter what it is. And then really focus on that spot. Really fixate on it. Really don't let your eyes waver one bit. Just really be there for it. So just really in that one little spot of the universe, say right there. And as you do that, notice what happens to your breathing. Does your breathing change at all? Okay, so you can take a deep breath and let go of that exercise. So, some of you, what changed? Did anybody experience a change in your breathing when you did that? Yes.
Became shallower.
The breath became shallower. Okay, someone else? Did your breathing change when you fixated your eyes on that spot? Yes. The breath became tighter. How many of you found that it was tighter? A lot of you. How many found it shallower? Okay, that's quite an impressive number. Anybody other options?
No change.
No change. Uh-huh, good. No change, so something no change. But it's quite common, the great majority of you had some change. You either got shallow or tight or both. That often happens if the mind gets fixated on something. And so if you're fixated on something psychological, some idea, some thought, some desire, some emotion, really kind of caught in it, really involved in a deep way, it affects a lot. It affects our breathing, it affects our musculature in our body, and it affects kind of the mind itself. Sometimes the mind feels tight or contracted or fragile or something. And so how having strong desires and being fixated on it, really focused, this is how what I want. I want this, I'm going to plan for it, this is important for me, has an impact on us. And that impact is important to see. And one of the things it does, it keeps us from being loose, relaxed, open. And so it makes us, someone talked about being shallow, so we become a little bit more, we don't feel as connected then. When we're soft and relaxed, then we're more connected to our wisdom, to our ability to see clearly. There's not the obscuration or the coverings of that fixation, that hardness, that tightness that comes with the being really caught by something, being involved with something. So often in daily life, this is often what people do. They are, when they're really concerned with something, really fixated on something, wanting something, or not wanting something strongly, it has an impact on us. And one of the functions of meditation is to learn to relax that fixation and to be soft, relaxed, at ease. However, there's a reason why people get fixated on desires or fixated on aversions, and that is some part of us believes it's we're trying to take care of ourselves the best we can. We're trying to be safer. We're trying to be, you know, to have comfort. We're trying to get something that we think is meaningful, and it's a little bit it can be counterproductive. Because the more shallow or contracted or tight we are, even if we get what we want, we might get it through the filter of that tightness. And then it might not really touch our heart as deeply as it really could. We might not register it so fully. But to learn to operate from aspiration, I think of, you know, just it's what arises out of being relaxed or at ease or having a soft breath. And feeling a desire, an aspiration, and then trusting that and coming from that and responding to the world in an easy way, then if the world responds in various ways, then we have the ability to receive that and feel it in a deeper, wiser, clearer way. And so some of the beautiful things of life, we can receive and be touched by it in wonderful ways that we can't if we're kind of caught up in our preoccupations. And then paradoxically, sometimes if you're really relaxed, not always the case for everyone, so I don't think it has to be this way, but sometimes if you're really kind of breathing easily, then things that are difficult to happen, sometimes there's more resilience in the system to receive and let it pass through. But if we're tight, then we're much more brittle and things will kind of impact us more. And I saw this when I was a Zen student. This is kind of not a very dramatic story, but just a subtle one, small one. And it doesn't work this way for everyone, but during the, in Zen monasteries, the teacher would come around to adjust people's posture during the sitting. So we're sitting there kind of very straight and upright and doing our meditation. And suddenly, out of the blue, someone put their hands on their shoulders, and then they would adjust your posture. And if I was preoccupied in very important thoughts, then if the hand touched my shoulders, I would startle. But if I was very present and not caught in my thoughts, I'd be just as surprised when someone touched me because it was out of the blue. But my body would be like a putty, just like, oh, okay. You know, I just go right through. That's how it is. And so that was not very interesting. We're trying to find a different way of being in the world. And so when we come back from this journey into our life as it usually is, maybe we come back and come from a different motivation, a different way of understanding how things work, or a different place within us than where we are now. And that's important because if all you learn to do is to learn to relax your stress, then you're going to have to do it over and over again. But if you learn how you get stressed out, then you can maybe prevent getting stressed in the first place. Does that make some sense? So it takes a lot. So what we're trying to do here is to also study ourselves and how does this work? You know, how do I get stressed? How do I get caught? What's this like? So that means that don't think that this is like supposed to be a direct path to nirvana. You know, like just, you know, I just want the fastest and quickest way to peace. You know, and you know that's what I want. This, you know, it's already 4:30 in the afternoon, the first day of the retreat, and I think this way they practice here at IRC. This must be really slow. I'm going to go find the fast path. There must be a faster way, better way. Once many years, I heard the story about the Dalai Lama many years ago there was a huge, I think in Arizona, huge conference hall filled with people to hear the Dalai Lama teach for a week or something. And there was time for questions and answers, and someone stood up and asked him a question. He said, how can I get enlightened quickly? The fast or something. And the Dalai Lama was silent for a long time. So that makes it kind of very... And then people who were close by noticed that he started to cry. And then he said something about that the idea that you should do it quickly is kind of misunderstanding, that somehow there's something lost in that process. There's a maturation, there's a learning, there's a humility, there's a compassion that get born when we are willing to kind of just meet ourselves. And this idea of being in a hurry just doesn't really respect the full range of what our hearts are about and what this human life, the complexity of human life. So part of taking our time is to take our time to understand the hindrances, to understand the challenges we have, the ways that we get caught and preoccupied. So the first one is sensual desire. In the Buddhist vocabulary, sensual desire means basically desiring anything in the material world. It's because this is the sensual world, the Buddhists call it. And so it's, wanting anything at all, not just what we think of as, you know, sensual or sexual or something like that. And in fact, one of the alternative words for this particular hindrance is to covet things, to want things of the world. So there's all kinds of things we want, but the idea is sometimes our wanting, we get caught in it, becomes a preoccupation. And it's very hard to be present because we kept being pulled off into wanting, wanting, wanting. Don't see it as a personal failing that you are caught in desire if that happens for you. None of these hindrances are meant to be seen as personal failings. Part of the wisdom of the wisdom teachings of Buddhism is that it's wise to not see these as personal things at all. They're just part of what comes along with being a human. You're not a bad person because you have a hindrance. It means you're a person. But the fact that it comes along with being a person doesn't mean that you have to be caught in it, but you can be wise about it, which means it means that you should look for opportunities to study your hindrances, to study when you get caught in desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. Don't go making them up so you can study them. Don't go look for trouble. But if they occur, I suggest that your attitude could be, great. Look at this. Wow, I get to look at this. I get to understand. Start to learn a different relationship to this, to desire, to aversion, all these things. And this is part of the practice, is to learn how to be with it in a different way. So this is some ways to practice with sensual desire. And there's a series of things you can do, and you can decide what's wise and appropriate for you. Sometimes it's appropriate to, rather than focusing on it, like what I'm saying, studying it, sometimes it's really appropriate to ignore it. and go back to your breath. Kind of give more emphasis on the breath. Because sometimes when we're caught in sensual desire, it really represents kind of superficial quality of the mind. And if it just feels like superficial kind of thing that you want, like, you know, how many times do you, you know, you're just thinking about dessert all the time. Now, maybe dessert has a certain profundity to it, and I don't want to deny it has its place. But you know, if you've had, you know, spent two meditation sessions here thinking about dessert, I maybe you could just assume that it's superficial. And you know, come back, and maybe just ignore it, just come back and give more effort, get a little more serious, without straining or struggling. Get, you know, this is what you're doing here is really important. I can't underscore how important it is for yourself and for the world to do what we're doing here. Come back to your breathing. And if you can stay with the breath and just stay there, what happens is that that return to the breath, letting go, we begin letting go of many of the normal preoccupations, concerns, ways in which we see ourselves, see the world around us. And we're part of this journey of withdrawal, of leaving everything behind, so we can go into this new space, sacred space, where things are fresh and new and empty of the usual roles and thoughts and everything. And the breath can guide you to that space if you stay on the breath and let go of everything else. So sometimes that's what's best. Just don't get so involved in what takes you away, what gets you caught, if you're successfully can just come back to the breath. If that doesn't work well, then that's the time to begin studying the whole phenomenon of hindrance. Turn towards it with mindfulness. And sometimes a little bit of reflection is useful. You can just think a little bit, is this really the time and place to want this stuff? Or is this really wise what I want? Should I really be wanting this thing? What are the drawbacks of this particular desire? You know, what are the drawbacks of dessert? Desserts are good, but there must be drawbacks too. And so, you know, maybe it kind of frees you up just seeing the drawbacks of the particular desire you have. But more what mindfulness practice is, it's a very interesting movement of mindfulness practice. And this is kind of like the heart of this practice. And that is, if you have a desire, generally we have a desire for something. And so there's an object for the desire. And if there's an object for the desire, the mind is focused on that object. It's thinking about it. And if it's in sight, looking at it. And the more we're caught or preoccupied by that object of desire, the less we notice about other things. The less wisdom, less we notice what goes on inside of us. And so what we're trying to do, say that this is a very nice clock, and I think I'd really like this clock. Boy, I wonder, I really would want like to have this. I wonder how much it costs. I wonder where I can order it. Boy, you know, I bet my meditations would go really well with a clock like this. And it has this, you know, actually, you don't know this maybe, but it has a nice meditation bell sound you can program, and you can, wow, that's a nice sound, and you know, I'd probably be a better meditator, probably a better teacher if I had this kind of, you know, clock from a leading meditation, and it'd be nice to have, and I'm sure IRC doesn't need it. There's another one up here, and you know, I wonder if they'll notice if it's gone, and you know, I can be caught up in it, right? So, the mindful movement is very interesting. This is really a way of finding the path to practice. If you want to enter this journey of the Dharma in a deep way, you have to be able to understand this distinction. So, what I gave you is an example of being focused on the clock and wanting it and thinking about it and all that, right? So I can keep wanting it, but instead of having my focus, preoccupation, go to the clock, turn the attention around 180 degrees to feel what it's like to be wanting it, the subjective experience of having desire. So like if I'm holding on to this for dear life, I really want it, I'm holding on real tight, I'm so concerned about the clock and wanting it and what it's going to do for my life, that I don't notice the cost, the impact it has on me of having that desire. But if someone tells me, Gil, what's it like to hold the clock? I say, oh, it's, I think my hand's getting numb and stiff, you know, and, you know, it's like I've been holding it, clutching it so tight. Only then, when someone turns my attention to the holding of it, what it's like, do I notice how painful it is to hold it. So the mindful movement and where the Dharma is found, the Dharma path, the journey, is to learn to take that 180-degree turn and look inside of you. You don't have to reject the desire and what you want, but you turn around and see how is it that you, what is the inner experience like of having this desire, of wanting this? So if you're spending a lot of time wanting a really good experience in meditation, I really want that. I had that last retreat, and I just tried to, how do I get that? And how do I? I remember I wore that shirt, and it's like, you know, it's like baseball players. Apparently, if they do really well in one game, they wear the same underwear or something. Just they get superstitious. You know, everything should be the same. So you know, but so you turn around, and you, what's it like to be caught, to be wanting? And you discover maybe many things. You might discover that it's tiring. You might discover that it kind of hurts. It's kind of uncomfortable to be caught in the grip of desire and wanting. You might discover that it's actually kind of alienating. You're kind of a little bit not quite connected to yourself. The more you want that clock, the less you know about yourself. The more you're thinking about the clock, the less you're connected. So it's kind of alienating, disconnecting to do it. I used to love going to bookstores when books were all we had. I was pretty young, and I noticed that after a while that I had no money, but I go to bookstores, and I noticed after a while that I'd leave the bookstores exhausted. So then I started, what's going on here with me? And then I noticed that when I went to bookstores, I would look at all these books. I want that, I want that, I want that, I want that. And it was that, you know, I was so greedy and for books that by the time I left the bookstore, that movement of wanting was just drained me so thoroughly. So it's possible to study this. What's the impact? What's the cost? What's it like subjectively to be caught in desire? What happens to your breathing? What's happened to your posture? What's happened to your musculature? What's happened to your brain? What's happening with the freedom in your mind? How free are you? To really feel, to study and discover how little freedom you have when you're caught in the grip of desire is a great study. Rather than being discouraged, say, great, I'm studying something about the human nature, how it works. This is what it's like for a human being to be caught in desire. This is what it's like for a person not to be free in his own, her own mind. Great. That's really the attitude, if you can. Please. Great. Whatever you notice, wow. That's a lot better than some of the alternatives. Oh, no, not again. I'm a bad person. I shouldn't be this way. This shouldn't be happening. But rather, study. Be interested in it. Be willing to open to it. But if you can turn in and feel the subjective experience, it does a number of things. One is it helps you become wiser about what's going on. But it also, when you really allow yourself to be aware of the subjective experience, it kind of metaphorically gives breathing room to your inner subjective experience. And so things can begin to loosen up. Relax, to open up. You can breathe with the subjective experience. Keep breathing. Allow your breathing to start becoming fluid again. Fluid, relaxed breathing is the great lubricant. Lubricant of the heart, lubricant of the mind. It's, as the exercise maybe showed, it's actually hard to get fixated on something if your breathing is really relaxed and open. So see if you can come back to that. It's interesting to notice when you have a lot of desire, to notice where is the energetic center in your body of wanting it. I remember once when I first started studying that myself was in a monastery in Thailand. And I was fairly relaxed meditating, but then it was lunchtime. And I noticed that whenever I went for lunch, I was a foot in front, my center of gravity was a foot in front of me. I was leaning forward, I wanted the food. We only had one meal a day, so it was important. Mm-hmm. But I was like, the desire to get to lunch was there, and I lost my centeredness in myself, because I was kind of ahead of myself. So I learned to pull back and drop back into myself, and then I'd be ahead of myself. Come back. Be with yourself, Gil, not with the lunch. And so you kind of, where's the center of gravity? What's energized? What's happening in your body? Sometimes it's helpful to, in a very relaxed way, to fully and honestly acknowledge that you're caught up in the grip of desire, grip of wanting. That's what's happening. Compassionately, clearly, you know, kindly. There's no obligation to practice in Buddhism, so you're off the hook from being judged. But it's good to acknowledge it and to really clearly be honest, clearly, oh yeah, I am caught in desire. That's what's happening now. There's that kind of clear, full acknowledgement is a kind of way of starting to become free. You can't really, for the moment you clearly acknowledge, ah, yes, I'm caught in desire, that's a moment of being not caught as much. And then you do it again, oh, desire. It's very helpful to name it, to acknowledge it. Feel it in the body. And then there's one other thing that the Buddha said about sensual desire, overcoming sensual desire. And this is maybe a little bit counterintuitive. And that is that develop a really, the best you can, develop, cultivate a sense of well-being. And the form of well-being that he advocated was the kind of well-being that can come from getting concentrated in meditation. So if you're able to, not an easy thing to do, but if you're able to really stay with the breath, for example, really let go of the thoughts, the ideas, the past and the future, and just really be here, be with the breath, so the breath becomes kind of absorbing for you, like reading a really good book, and you get absorbed in the book. Then there starts to well up certain kinds of feelings of well-being that are deeper than pleasure. And so when those become so satisfying, that they're more satisfying than anything that the world of sensuality, sensual world out there can provide you, then it becomes easier to let go of it. And what's nice about this approach, as difficult as it can be, is that then letting go of sensual desires is not seen as a deprivation. It doesn't feel like you're losing something and being deprived, or your life is diminished in some way because you're not thinking about all these desires, but rather your life is enhanced. And that's really what we're trying to look for, is to come into the present moment, to learn to let go enough, to really settle so we can be at home in our hearts, feel safe in our hearts, at rest in our hearts, so we can breathe easily with our hearts. And then, to whatever degree we can do that, that sooner or later, we'll return to our life. And we return to the complexity of our lives and difficulties and challenges of our life. But then we might begin understanding there's another way of responding to the life around us. Maybe there's more an intuitive way. Maybe there's more coming from aspiration, the motivations that arise out of the heart, as opposed to the motivations that arise out of the more superficial brain or mind that goes on, that may be from, based on maybe, I don't know, desire and fear and anger and all these things, reactivity. It's a beautiful thing to find this kind of, to go on this process, this journey, and find a kind of counterintuitive way of then coming back to the world, just like the monk who gave up everything and they gave him a cell phone, a smartphone. Who knows what you have. So I'd like to end this talk with reading a story of someone who did a 7-day retreat, just like you. Not that you have to have this experience, but maybe you could some way retell the story to yourself so that it applies to your life. Many people arrived at the monastery hoping to be admitted to the monastic order. Some were sent away since what they were searching for was not to be found in the monastery. Once there was a 30-year-old man who arrived at the monastery feeling exhausted, discouraged, and hopeless. He had decided he was no longer capable of living the worldly life. Perhaps, he hoped, the monastery would provide him with a path that would bring him freedom. It was the birth of his second child that had pushed the man over the edge. He could no longer manage to live with the frustration and the demands on his time that family life had become. He was also worn down by his older child's constant pushing limits of acceptable behavior. When he came to the monastery, he asked that he be put under the care of the abbess, or another great teacher who could help him find peace. He felt encouraged when he was told that this could be arranged. However, first he would have to prepare himself and prove himself to be worthy of sitting alone in meditation for 7 days in the small waiting room next to the main entrance of the monastery. The man cried for the first 2 days. During the third day, he was washed with alternating waves of nausea and fear. The fourth was spent reviewing his life. For the fifth and sixth days, he seemed to question every belief he had. By the seventh day, he was feeling calm and certainly more rested than when he arrived days earlier. At the end of the seventh day, he eagerly waited to be admitted into the monastery to find out who would be his teacher. When the 7 days were over, the abbess herself came for the man. She congratulated him on completing the solitary retreat. "Come," said the abbess, "and I will introduce you to your new teachers." It took a while to figure out who was right for you, but we have found the ideal people who can help you find both your spiritual strength and your freedom. The abbess then led the man out the front gate of the monastery. Waiting for him there was his wife and 2 children. Happy to see them, the man raced out to embrace them. Then the abbess declared, "Your wife and 2 children are your ideal teachers. In your case, nowhere else but in your own family will you find the freedom you are looking for." With that, the abbess closed the monastery gate. So, a journey of withdrawal and return. So here's your 7 days. And I hope it's easier for you than this man. And one way or the other, you'll return. And maybe when you return, you'll find your ideal teacher. If you return, having discovered some capacity to be at rest in yourself, be at rest or at ease here and now, this time in this place, not in front of yourself in the future, not behind yourself in the past, not in the clouds of fantasy, but here, resting, rooted in this moment, ready to receive, ready to be open, ready to meet the life that you have. So it's a custom here at many retreats, but here as well, to end the talks with kind of coming back into the retreat mode, meditative mode, kind of. So you might take your posture for a minute or so and